Standby. Good day, everyone. Welcome to today's IBM Lessons Learned from Data Sharing Health Checks conference call. Today's call is being recorded. For opening remarks and introductions, I would like to turn the conference over to Diane McClellan. Please go ahead.
Welcome, everybody, to Data Sharing Health Checks, What We Have Learned. My name is Diane McClellan, and I am the worldwide sales leader for IBM's DB2 for Z and DB2 and IMS tools. I will be your host today. Our speaker today is Judy Ruby Brown, a senior consulting IT specialist for DB2 for ZOS, a member of IBM's Advanced Technical Support Organization, better known as ATS. And now I'd like to turn it over to Judy. Judy?
Thank you, Diane. I have been in the Dallas System Center for about 18 years. It is part of IBM's Advanced Technical Support Organization, as Diane stated. For DB2, IMS, and CICS, our departments have been positioned between development and the IBM field and individual customers. We have a sister organization, the Washington System Center, that does the same thing for ZOS, WebSphere, Z Linux, and server hardware. So what I have been is a part of a cross-disciplinary team of the Dallas System Center and Washington System Center that goes to large IBM customers over the last 4 years to analyze the parallel sysplex infrastructure. It takes about 3 weeks to do this type of health check, including preparation, review of documentation, on-site work, and a written report that follows up. Our groups focus on the parallel sysplex. And why is that? It's a necessary skill, but not everyone in IBM needs to have it. Our organizations have been very deep into parallel sysplex since the early 1990s. On this health check, which really is a health check, we just ask the questions, how are we doing for availability in the infrastructure? Performance is of less importance here, although we do point out certain things that we might see. But we do not get down to the application level, and we don't do root cause analysis on PMRs or defects. Other people can do that, and it usually requires longer than we have. So really, it is a health check. Your handout has slides that are titled Notes. There are detailed explanations for the slide preceding it. They are for your reference, and they're hidden during this presentation. I'm going to give the slide number, and I hope the title, as I turn the page. So on page 3, we're talking about the agenda. I'm going to talk about 5 different topics: keeping up with structure sizing, autonomic tuning of group buffer pool structures, DBM1 virtual storage, how much do we have for real work, problems that we might experience with ICF-only configurations, and what I call the usual suspects that most people have that are DB2 related. So I will start now with keeping up with structure sizing, and I am now on page 5, and the title is GBP sizing. Now, if you'll look at the picture, on the left-hand side, we have DB2A that has a buffer pool, and in it is a page 1 and page 2 from some table space. On the right-hand side, we have DB2B. Its buffer pool 1 contains page 3 and page 4. Now, if we look at the GBP pool, GBP1, the backing group buffer pool, for buffer pool 1, it has page 5. So, and there are small things that are called P1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. These are directory entries. Each page in a local buffer pool has a directory entry, and so does the page in the group buffer pool. Note that page 5 does not reside in either DB2A or DB2AB, but it must have a directory entry. In this example, each page is unique in the data sharing group, and this represents the worst case situation where every page is unique. Now on page 7, where I'm talking about initial group buffer pool sizing, that is, sizing before you all went into data sharing, which of course this presentation assumes you are already in data sharing, so we work with whatever size you happen to get. Still, it's very handy to be able to know how to estimate the correct size in case there are numbers that are way off. So, there are several ways you can do this before you get into data sharing. And our purpose has been a safety goal. We would like to over-allocate so that you don't shoot yourself in the foot, as we in the state of Texas might say. There is a capability called CF Sizer that is at the URL that is listed in your slide, and that is probably the easiest way to size group buffer pools. And the advantage is that it connects. It's an external website. It's not internal IBM only. Everybody can use it. It connects to a live server for calculation of the latest coupling facility control code level. That's what CFCC means. There are also formulas in the Data Sharing Planning and Administration Guide. And the third option is a Dallas System Center formula to size the init size of a group buffer pool. And what we've done since 1996 is we have summed the virtual pool and hyperpool pages for the number of members expected, convert it to K because that's how it's allocated in the coupling facility, the CFRM policy, and then take 40% of the results. That provides enough directory entries to avoid cross-invalidation. If you are starting out with over 4 members, it might over-allocate your group buffer pool. As of March in 2006, we discovered that the Dallas System Center formula that we used since 1996, which took 33% or a third instead of 40%, no longer worked, no longer guaranteed you that there were no cross-invalidations due to directory reclaims. Because there have been changes to the structure storage for the CFCC over time, probably since Coupling Facility Control Code 12, and now we're into 14. So it seems easier to me to point towards CF Sizer and let it do the work. And then I round it up to the next multiple so that you can remember it. And that compares pretty closely with the 40% of the Dallas System Center formula. But in fact, neither one will guarantee you have no excise due to directory reclaims, which is what we're trying to avoid. I have another way that we can do that later on. So, on page 9, why these are bad? Why are they bad? Well, cross-invalidations due to directory reclaims, you will see in the RMF coupling facility activity report. For the RMF interval, these should be zero. Normally, what happens when we have a group buffer pool dependent data set is we read the page from DASI to the local buffer pool and we register it with one of those little directory entries in the group buffer pool. Now, if we do not have enough directory entries, we're going to incur both CPU and I/O overhead. Because if I go to read a page in my local buffer pool, if the directory entry has been stolen, a cross-invalidation signal is sent to my local buffer pool. So I will see that the page is there, but I will also know that it's invalid. So where do I go to get it? Well, architecturally, data sharing says the next place we go is to the group buffer pool. Well, it's not going to be there because I just read it. So then I have to do a synchronous read to DASI to retrieve the page and go to the coupling facility again to register that page. That's why in the middle of the page it says we cause 2 CF accesses and 1 sync DASI page read. This is a performance problem, not necessarily availability. An availability problem occurs when we have writes failed due to lack of storage. That simply meant we could not write a page to the group buffer pool. We didn't have enough storage. That value should be zero. If we don't have enough space to write a page, then DV2 will perform cast out, trying to write out enough pages so we can write these pages that have to go to the group buffer pool. And we'll try several times to write those pages. But if we still can't do it, then the pages are added to the logical page list called LTL. Those pages are then unavailable until they are recovered from LTL, which is done by a simple start command and automatically in version 8. But this is an availability problem. So we, now that we have sized the group buffer pools correctly, or we know how to do it, what should we do about the lock structure? On page 11, the question, the title says, what about the lock structure? Well, that I monitor exclusively with the RMF coupling facility activity report. And I look for false contention of less than 1% as acceptable. Looking on the right-hand side of the report, you look at false contention over total requests on the right-hand side. Now, the reason I don't use DB2PM or Tivoli or Megamon XE for DB2PM is because since ZOS 1.2, which is very old, there's a heuristic algorithm in which XES figures out how long a synchronous response is occurring from the host to the CF, and if it's too long, it will convert that synchronous request to asynchronous. Well, at one time, DB2PM calculated a huge number of percentage based on this conversion erroneously. So, and sometimes based on service, they didn't include it at all. So I completely ignore that. Now, the other thing I can do is I can also specify number of lock table entries on each IRLM startup proc. And the reason I'm going to do this is because when I have false contention that is frequently a size of a structure that's too small. What is false contention? False contention occurs when table space A in one member and table space B from another member hash to the same place in the locked table entry. The hashing is done on a DBID, PSID, OBID type of algorithm, and if there are not enough slots in the lock table, it's possible that these two things will hash to the same entry, and that will cause contention because it's thought by XCS that there is a contention problem. As it turns out, you and I know that table space A and table space B have nothing to do with each other, and so that's granted. But you do have contention as a result, and that's what we're trying to eliminate by giving it more entries. So assume that we have a four-way data sharing group, and we've observed false contention is 3%, and according to RMF, our lock table entry size is 64 megs. Well, if I look on the CFRM structure statement on the policy, we'll see a value that says init size 256,000K, size is 256,000K. And what this yields is a lock table of 128 meg with a 64 meg lock table entry, and the other part of the lock structure is the modify lock list, and that's 128 meg. I'll go a little bit slower. The lock table is always an even multiple of 2. So in the case where we have 128 meg, then it's divided, so that's half of 256. And we also have, we say that we have 64 million lock table entries. We divide that by the width of the structure. And up through 6 members, that is 2 bytes per entry. Therefore, I have a lock table entry. I have 64 million entries. So what I want to do is I want to increase the lock table entry to 128 meg. That's the lock table entries. I'm doubling that to reduce the false contention. So looking at the next slide, I have two ways to get 128 million lock table entries. This is on page 12. I can specify the size in either of two ways. On the structure statement, I can say a NIP size 512,000, size is 512,000. That will get me a lock table of 256 meg, half of 5,012, and or the 128 million lock table entries. And it will give me a modified lock list of 256 meg. But I may not need that. I don't necessarily need that. I don't need any more lock table, lock list entries. So what I can do is I can also give it an init size of 390,000. Then that gives me a lock table of 256 meg as I want with 128 million lock table entries and the modified lock list of only 134 meg. Because we're going to divide by 2 to get the even value of 2, and then there will be a rounding up or a rounding down to the desired entry, whichever is closer. We always have to rebuild the structure to change the size of the lock table. Another way we can do that, and in the first case, all I did it was by the structure size. The other option is I can specify the number of entries that I want using the LTE equals 128 on your IRLM startup proc for each IRLM. Just make sure that the number of entries is the same, is in sync with whatever the CFRM init size is. And I have some notes about that. But basically, in that way, you don't have to rely on the dividing by two aspect because the lock table specification takes precedence over the structure unless there's not enough size. And in that case, it would fall back to a 50-50 split. And there's some service recommendations. So that was, so on page 14, where we're talking about locking it, we talked about eliminating false contention, and we do that by increasing the size of the structure. Now, the other issue we have is we've got lock contention, which is on page 14, and the title is still on locking. Most global lock contention, that is greater than 5%, and we'd like to say less than 5%, is usually XES parent locking and will not decrease until version 8 new function mode. And by the end of second quarter 2006, I have not seen a version 8 new function mode customer. So thus, this presentation is mostly based on version 7 experience. The lock table entries on the LRM proc can give you a finer tuning than doubling the size. The problem I've seen in the past is where we had mismatched CPU to coupling facility and or distance. When we have a very fast Z9 or Z990 processor going to a -1 or -2 generation coupling facility, then the heuristic algorithm of XES in ZOS spares the spin time on the Z990 and converts synchronous lock requests to async. And if the percentage is large, then the lock request time goes up. One user I saw a couple of years ago had a Z900 connected to a 9672 R6, which was older processor. And instead of the expected 40 microseconds for a synchronous lock request, 75 to 85% of them were converted to async at 120 microseconds per request. So that was a really bad problem, and they were also doing row-level locking. So it's important to keep your coupling facilities no older than a kind of the -1 generation. So I finished talking about how you do sizing. So now let's talk about something called AutoWalter for couch potatoes. That's page 15. And so going to page 16, I always ask the question of customers, how do you tune your DB2 group buffer pool? And in almost every situation, it's deafening silence. Nobody does it. Well, one customer did it, but they guessed wrong. Well, why is that? Well, one, it's really hard to do. But another one is political. ZOS owns the CFRM policy, the RMFCF activity reports, and the structures. They don't do DB2. The DB2 guys can't have to go to the ZOS people to get structure sizes increased. So we already have a communication problem. So let's do something automatic, not autonomic, and get a gold star from our management. This is how we work smart. On page 17, I'm showing you a chart of recent experiences that I've had with some pretty large customers. On the right is a table that shows group buffer pools, what size they were at the time, what was the maximum size they could reach, and how many cross invalidations due to directory reclaims they had. Well, they did not even know to look for this. And in 2 days, they achieved these values, where four large group buffer pools were greater than 100 million, and 9 of 14 were greater than 1 million. The command I use to say this is a display group buffer pool asterisk G detail asterisk that gets me from the start, whenever that was first allocated. Type GCON says, only give me the group buffer pools that are connected to this member. That way we aren't flooding it with 60 group buffer pools, almost none of which are allocated. So it's a very easy command to do. The other thing that can happen is on page 18, and write failures due to lack of storage. Another customer where we have the group buffer pools, and we show that we have 21 writes failed due to lack of storage for group buffer pool 4. And notice the directory to data ratio is a 5-to-1. That's the standard default. So on page 19, I have a goal for all the customers I see, and that is for proactive tuning. I want you to allocate large group buffer pools. For example, 2 times the current allocation if you're happy with whatever it is, because I want to handle long-term growth so that the local DB2 guys can increase the local buffer pool sizes, change sizes around at will without having to worry about talking to the MBS people about the structure sizes, or maybe even add data sharing members. So what I want to have happen is I'm going to have let a capability called auto-alter tune the directory to data ratio. And then later, 6 months, maybe a year later, DB2 and ZOS staff get up off the couch, you know, have a few adult beverages or lunch, and update these things as needed. So the rest of this section is going to describe how this works and how you can make it work for you. So on page 20, what is auto-alter? It is an autonomic effort by XES to avoid filling up structures. I mean, if all data elements, which are pages, are changed, we can't be writing. If directory elements are marked change, then new pages can't be registered. AutoAlter has some algorithms that can increase or decrease the number of entries and or elements to avoid structure full conditions. And it can also dynamically increase or decrease the size of the structure. It can alter dynamically the precise directory to data growth data ratio for group buffer pools, which is the primary reason I like this. And the design point is that you're going to get gradual growth. We're not trying to accommodate spikes. And this capability, which is a ZOS capability, is not DB2 specific, and it works for all structures in the CF. So on page 21, how do I specify auto-alter? Your ZOS people will implement it through the structure statement in the CFRM policy. I wanted to show you an example so you could see how easy it is to specify. All you say is allow auto-alt yes. That permits XCF to come in and alter the structure if needed. Specify full thresholds. If you don't, 80% is the value. When either entries or elements exceed this threshold, then XCF can increase one or the other. Specify min size. What's min size? XCS can, in certain situations, when there's stress on a coupling facility, lower the sizes of the structures, but it will never lower it lower than min size. The default is 75%. So in the example I show for DB2 GROB group buffer pool 3, we have an init size of 1 gig, a size of 2 gig. I have a preference list. I have full thresholds of 80. I mean, I could have left it out, but I wanted to show you. Min size is 1,000,000. I've left it the same as init size. And the magic word, allow all to auto all, yes. Also, duplex enabled. That's a given. And group buffer pool duplexing is critical for availability among all the customers I see. But right now we're talking about auto alter. So on page 22, the DB2 structures that support auto alter are the lock table and the SCA. Now remember I said to you earlier that all it's effective for is on the modify lock list, which are called record list entries, because the lock table entries cannot be changed without a rebuild. But this is pretty handy to use. You can use this pretty effectively, particularly if you're in an ERP environment where you may take a whole lot of locks and keep them a long time. But the main value is for group buffer pools. And the reason is because people don't tune them. As I said earlier, it has to do with the organizational division of labor. But also, DB2 needs some number more directory entries than data page elements, and there's no easy way to figure this out. And by the way, if you do try to do this and you do alter commands, DB2 commands, then when you change the directory entries, then you've got to manually rebuild the structure. So now, on page 23, the structure full algorithm says there are actually two algorithms. One is structure full avoidance. We don't want the structure to ever become full. And two is the directory entry or reclaim avoidance. That aspect is subordinate to number one. Structure full avoidance uses something called full structure monitoring to monitor both changed entries and elements. This capability comes in all the time anyway, every few seconds. And I can't remember the exact number, and it's internal. It can be changed anytime by PTF. But in terms of seconds, I don't know if it's 15 seconds or 30 seconds, something like that. It comes in all the time anyway to see if structures are getting full. So there's no extra overhead for doing this. But now, if either directory entries or elements exceed full threshold, XES is viewing this as an impending catastrophe to avoid at all possible times. Now, with this service that's pretty old, a couple of years old, if either one or the other exceeds full threshold, XES is going to increase the size slightly and also give you more of what you need. Increases one and decreases the other. Full structure monitoring is very old. It came in version OS release 2.9. It's way out of service. So this has been happening for a long time in the ZOS environment. On page 24, the second algorithm is reclaim avoidance. And it uses statistics that it obtains to determine if directory entry reclaim is occurring for any reason. Structure full cares only about changed entries. Reclaim avoidance, it doesn't matter. If it's noticing that reclaims occur too frequently, then XES increases the number of directory entries and decreases the number of data page elements, up to a 40-to-1 ratio. So to summarize on page 25, structure size manipulation summary. If either changed entries or elements exceed full thresholds, XES will increase the structure size to gain enough capacity. AutoAlter can decrease a structure size only if the CF itself is under stress and it has to be less than 10% of free storage. Then it will steal storage from all the structures with allow AutoAlter, but will not reduce them to less than the min size value. And you probably don't want it to go below that init size anyway. Reclaim avoidance never, ever changes the size of a structure. but it increases the directory entries and reduces the data pages. On page 26, I'm going to review quickly DB2's mechanisms to avoid structure pools. With large group buffer pools and the fast Z900, 990, Z9 processors and lots of shared data sets, we want you to tune pretty aggressively for large group buffer pools. And what is large? Well, several in development have said large is greater than 1 gig. I'm assuming that pretty large is greater than 500,000K, or half a gig. So I'm happy defaulting full threshold to 80%. What we're trying to do is to dribble cast out to avoid hitting thresholds. In the table, you will see the threshold and what is recommended and what is the current default. That default is version 7 default. In version 8, the default for group buffer pool checkpoint, for example, is 4 minutes. Class T is the value that's analogous to the virtual deferred write threshold. GB pool T is analogous to the deferred write threshold. So those are the recommendations. Now, on page 27, what about class T? The premise, as stated in the data sharing guide, is to match those thresholds from non-data sharing to the same ones for class T. But I've seen a lot of 0% vertical deferred write threshold translating into 0 class T. What does this mean? Well, when 40 pages in a cast-out class are updated, then DB2 will cast out. Except if 1% of the actual number of the pages is less than 40 pages. What this means is if I had class T specified as 0 and the number of actual pages in the group buffer pool were 1,400, then cast-out is going to occur at 14 pages since 1% is less than 40 pages. And please be aware that the number of data pages is not the same thing as a NIP size. You can find the number of actual pages in the display group buffer pool command. And as an example, I show that a NIP size of a little over 11,000 resulted in 1,125 pages at a 15-to-1 ratio. So that's what happens when 0% occurs. 1%, what about 1%? Since DB2 gathers 128 pages at a time for cast out, don't use 1% unless your actual number of data pages from the display command is 12,800 pages. So in those cases, I would choose different values than what you have in your vertical deferred write threshold. Now, vertical deferred write threshold was very popular in the early 90s when there was old DASD or poorly performing DASD that couldn't handle spikes when the standard thresholds like 10% were hit. But decreasing it down to 0 was very good in terms of having even writes to DASD, but it increased CPU time in DBM1 address space. So the recommendation is use 0 if you have badly performing DASD. Otherwise, increase it for local buffer pools. Now, cast-out has a lot more overhead than just writing to DASD because we have to gather storage, grab a number of data sets, and perform that activity. So we don't want to do that too often. So on page 29, what are our recommendations for class T? Generally speaking, stick with the defaults unless you know your data. If you don't get any reuse of the data, then there's no benefit in keeping it in a group buffer pool. So you might as well write it out as soon as possible and set class T to 1% as long as you've got 12,800 genuine pages. If reuse is high, you can raise it, but don't cause it to hit GB pool T. But my experience is that many customers do not know what's in a group buffer pool or their local buffer pools or the contents are mixed, so it's safe to use the default. So here's kind of a little guideline. You can use 1-2% if your group buffer pool and NIP size is greater than 500,000. Otherwise, try 5%. So some people have organized buffer pools functionally, I found. In other words, you know, buffer pool 2, local buffer pool 2 is for simple tables, table spaces, buffer pool 3 is for partition, 4 is NPIs, et cetera. And that's easy from a functional standpoint, but it doesn't attempt, there's no attempt to arrange buffer pools for performance based on the data. For example, like code tables that you may want to actually fix in a buffer pool, or specific index levels. So that's just my experience over the last several years. Okay, on page 30, when should you not use AutoAlter? Don't do it if CFCC level is less than 12 because you're limited to 2 gigabytes control storage. However, that's 3 years ago. I have seen no one that's in that situation. I doubt if many people, if anybody still is. So I think that's a no-brainer. If you don't have enough CF storage, if it's less than 10%, because AutoAlter can reduce the size of the structure. If you don't have enough storage to size the structure, particularly in test environments, then try not to do this either, because XCS is going to reach a size quickly. And reclaim avoidance is going to result in constant XCS attempts to increase directory entries and reduce data pages. And if you can't go anywhere in the size, the attempts are usually fruitless and have alarming console messages. I have an example and a couple of foils on a customer that was doing this on a test basis. Okay, on page 31, don't use it if you don't have enough storage. In this particular case, there was a four-way data sharing group, and this customer was testing what AutoAlter was supposed to do. His local buffer pool size was 30,000 pages. The init size should have been 175,000K. However, on his structure statement, his init size was only 30 meg, and with a size of almost 40 meg. So it was very critically undersized. Looking on page 33, here are some actual abbreviated console messages. You get a message that says AutoAlter processing is initiated for, and it gives group buffer pool 3. It shows the current size and the target size. And if you'll remember, that was the size as I showed you in the structure statement. The target entry to element ratio is 36,275 to 16,488. What does this mean? Well, it means nothing to you because XES is calculating a ratio based on what it considers to be ideal. The important thing to remember is what the ratio actually is. In red, I have shown that I divided these two, the target element entry to element ratio, and I came up with 2.20. That's going to be the ratio that it's going to actually get. That point in red is not issued. That's something I came up with. That's not part of the message. So the next message says, okay, automatic alter is trying to do this. It's completed, and it shows target not attained. It shows the current size. It shows the current entry count, which was 7,269, and it was trying to get 17,891. Its element count, that's the page count, was 8181, and it was trying to go down to 8130. And the next line had to do with duplexing, and I didn't include all of those entries. So I took the ratio of 17,269 to 8181, and all we got was 2.11. So the target was not attained. And we were already at the size, so we didn't have any way to go. But even if we had, just directory entries will not cause it to be increased. So on the next page, which is page 34, we see that the target was attained. Once more, we have the IXC 588 message initiated. And this time, the target entry to element ratio, which I divided for you again in red, is 2.32. In this case, the target was attained, as the next message shows. We went for the entry to element count, and we came up. It was 2.32, and we actually obtained that. Now, what happens, but we kept on, and once more tried to alter and page 35, and it was trying to get a ratio of 3.63. The target was not attained because it only had 3.56. So what happened is the reclaim avoidance in this customer's place occurred 7 times in 10 minutes. There was never any structure full. So this was kind of an alarming message. So that was a situation in the test environment where the main problem in testing was the structure was not sized correctly to begin with. So it was really an invalid test. If you don't have enough storage to test all of them, then size one correctly and test that. So my conclusions on auto-alter are the advantages are that it's automatic. You give the guidelines and get out of the way. It alters the ratios without a structure rebuild. It dynamically changes them inside the coupling facility. And it builds a better directory to data ratio than any of us could do. It avoids write failures due to lack of storage. It can increase the modify lock list of the lock structure when necessary. But what are the disadvantages? Well, a low setting of full threshold can cause a disruptive structure full activity. And by the way, for more information on this, your notes talk about looking at the ZOS manual setting up a SysPlex for your particular release of ZOS. So what we want to do is we want to, under conclusions, which is on page 38, we want to set full threshold for activation in an emergency. Now, DB2 has its own full group buffer pool messages. So if you use 80%, you're not going to see the 90% message. Do not make it close to GB pool T. A sudden spurt in pages and a temporary lag in cast out can put you over the edge. Small group buffer pools may not have many pages between GB pool T and current elements if you have a low threshold. Now, it's okay if you use a GB pool T of 25%, then you're pretty much going to be pretty safe. If you plan to use it for proactive tuning for increases in group buffer pools or new members, allocate it much larger initially. Oh, and don't use it if you have minimal CF storage or want to have tight control. One customer that I saw several years ago, which is the largest data sharing group in the world, sent me information, and they were using auto-alter, and they were doing just fine. And I asked them about the number of members. They said, well, we have 14. And I said, well, I see 15 connectors on this group buffer pool thing, display command. They said, oh, I guess we added a member last week. My point is, they added a member. They had enough storage. AutoAlter was able to absorb all that information without missing a beat. So that is the real advantage of this. Okay, I am finished with the section on auto-alter. So now let me go on to virtual storage in DBM1. Now, John Campbell talks a great deal about virtual storage and being on the virtual storage budget. And there's a RexExec that he puts out, and I've distributed as well, that allows you to calculate these values. Well, this section is going to describe a little bit of how to run it and what you do with it after you get the output. So this is a very important part of any analysis I do for a customer. Many customers in version 7 are very, very tight on DVM1 virtual storage. And if you've listened to John at all, you can tell that if there's not enough virtual storage, if there's too much work coming in for the virtual storage, then you can have some ABIN problems and DB2 can fail. So it's an availability issue. And it's usually caused by customers not knowing what values to set for DSN ZPARM, C-Thread, or MaxDBAT. So looking at slide 41, how much work can you get through a DB2 member? This information is pretty much unknown. And sometimes it's set on off-the-wall recommendations by a lot of people who haven't gone through it. And that may be too much or not for your particular system. So a good measure of capacity for a DB2 is how much work can I pump through there. So in the case where DBM1 is going short, doesn't have enough virtual storage for the work that's coming in, it will go through, it accumulates storage as it's alive, as it's up, that it doesn't normally release. And it doesn't do that for a couple of really good reasons. We don't want to go through free mains and get mains for each particular thread, so we want to keep that thread storage around, a lot of storage around, and allocate it to current users. So if we go short on storage to a certain threshold, then DB2 will compact its storage right then and there. That is a CPU-intensive situation. It's nothing that's measurable or trackable or anything, and it's a serious availability situation, but it's also a pretty serious performance situation. So if things don't get better, then it will ABIN current work with either EZ2003 ABINs or EZ2016 ABINs. It's ABINing current work in order to keep itself up. And it can actually fail if we have no storage available and we are doing something like backing out the current work we had to cancel, because backout is a must-complete function. And if we can't complete it, we would lose data integrity, so DB2 has to fail. Now, for past years, RMF Virtual Storage identified the virtual storage, and you could see when it was getting low, but it couldn't tell you what DB2 was actually using it. So several years ago, ISC ID 225 identified major consumers of virtual storage. You could get that information in the statistics long DBM1 storage section or in record trace. But most monitors don't have that capability. And in fact, in 4 years, I haven't seen anything other than DBM1 or DB2PM that had this information. So that was one of the reasons this REX code was written, and this is as-is code given to you. And by the way, at the end of this section, the URL is there so that you can get this downloaded and run it yourself. So it includes primarily IFCID data, but it includes a little bit of other data. So the rest of this section is going to describe how you use this to get the information you need to answer your question. How many threads can I support in this DB2? On page 42 is the MIMU zip package. It's as-is REX code, that means no support is provided. John Campbell did it. I documented it initially. And it's composed of four things. It's got two REX execs. One is MIMU2. Sometimes in various versions it's called MIMU, but, you know, either way it's the same thing. It outputs ISCID information when it's invoked as a batch job. There's another flavor of it that outputs the same information if you invoke it for TSO option 6. In other words, you execute MIMUsage, and it will provide right then and there one output of what the virtual storage is now. And oh, by the way, this is a snapshot. It's not a beginning interval, ending interval. It is a snapshot of right now. There's a MIMU2 JCL text file. That's a JCL, that's a sample of how you invoke it. And there's the documentation that we provided. So I want to talk about MIMU2 REX. It's invoked by a JCL on a single member basis. If you have two members, you run it on each member. If you have 17, you run it on 17 members. It outputs ISCID 225 into a comma delimited data set. The defaults of this exec are 5-minute intervals. This has nothing whatever to do with whatever your stat time is. You can set it whatever you want. And the default is 12 intervals. And at 5 times 12, that means an hour. If you change nothing, you'll get an hour. You have to specify a couple of things like your load library and what subsystem you're running in. There is some very old service from 2004 that has to be on in order for you for the REDES capability to be invoked, but most people probably have that on. On page 43, I have a sample of the JCL to invoke MIMU for one day. That was what I did. The underlined sysexec, I have it in a data set of mine, WC jobs. That's where I put the rexexec. You upload it, and that's where I put it. Then the other data set that I have is memusage.output, and that is a new data set. I delete it at the first, allocate it at the end. And by the way, so if this job fails, you lose all of the output. But that's just that probably somebody smart that cared about could probably change that. That's why we call it as is. You can enhance at your will. The control statements are the important ones. I identify MIMU2, which is the name of the rexexec. Judy. Now, if you want me to install a DBC subsystem for you at the Washington System Center, that's what you're going to get. I'm going to give it my ID, so that's what it is. And I overrode the number of intervals. I made it 288. That'll give me one day at 5-minute intervals. And by the way, you can make it 1-minute intervals, too, if you happen to be tracking a certain problem and you're concerned about a storage leak. But for the purposes I want to do, 5 minutes is just fine. On page 44, you will see a sample, a DB2PE sample of the statistics trace in the report. And this is not what your output is going to look like, but this is the output, and you can see that the indentations, the four major components of virtual storage are total get main, total variable, total fixed, and total get main stack storage. Those numbers are not always going to, in all cases, going to total up, 100%, because this was not designed to be run for bean counters, but to give kind of a general storage idea. So don't worry about if it doesn't balance out. That's what you get from DB2PM. Now, on page 45, what I want to do now that you've run the job, then how are we going to use it? We're going to create a spreadsheet from MIMU2 output. We're going to download it to the hard drive and bring up Excel and let the text wizard walk us through the creation of a spreadsheet from a comma delimited input. I added some columns at the end to make the calculations easier. And the formulas for those are listed in your notes page. The two values that are very important that I'm very interested in are maximum number of threads possible and total active threads. And these active threads include allied threads and active DBAS. When I graph the maximum threads and the total active threads against the time and the number of threads, which is number of threads is the y-axis, time is in the x-axis. There is on page 47, there is an example of a chart that I will find. This is from a DB2 version 7 customer. This represents a week's worth of data. They IPL once a week. So the top left, you see 2,000 to 2,500 threads, and I really ignore that because DB2 is kind of settling in. That's the maximum number of threads at that point. The bottom row, the pink row, you can see kind of gentle wave undulations, and this is a good thing. This represents a workload that is repeating over a number of days. The top blue line is the line that says this is the maximum number of threads possible according to my calculations. At 1352, we had a high value, but it's not repeated at all in our chart. However, on the right-hand side, at 1726.57, we show a high of 940. This is pretty good because several days have gone by and we still have enough storage to maintain 940 threads. So there are several points in the middle around 1911 that have 890, and so I choose several points lower, a little bit lower than the maximum, as a safe value. That's the value I've chosen, and you split that between C-thread and max DBAT. Now, there's notes pages that tell you how to create a chart in case you're not a charting wizard, as I certainly was not. But moving on to page 50 is an example. All this is showing you is what the Excel spreadsheet looked like before I graph it. And all I have done here is take a snippet of this. I take the top row, which has very long titles, and I wrap text so it's much easier to read. The yellow column headings are the ones that I have added. And at the very end, you can see maximum number of threads and total active threads. So the general guidelines that I would suggest to you as to how you can use these charts: throw away the first day or two while DB2 is settling in. This is on page 51. Throw away the abnormally low values for current active threads, especially after an interval of high values. One customer that had a batch DB2, in one interval they had about 20 batch jobs of about a little bit over 2 meg each with a thread footprint. Well, the next interval had only one batch job. It said that the thread footprint was almost 50 meg. Now, that wasn't really true, but remember, we had had storage that was accumulated on behalf of those 20, or some number that happened earlier in time. So watch out for certain anomalies like that. And, of course, if you had a high, if you said 50 meg, which is thread footprint, then obviously the maximum number of threads would be very low. So just throw those things out. Pay attention to month end or other peaks that you may know of, or maybe weekends where you've got reorg and heavy image copies can increase stress on virtual storage. Get several plot points to validate your choice, to be conservative. The most accurate storage is obtained as you get close to the maximum number of active threads, because that's all the DB2 storage. You're not amortizing storage on behalf of other threads. So you're going to have to apportion the current maximum thread value between C-thread and max DBAT. And the assumption of all this is that this is the charted workload, and it doesn't change. Obviously, it does change. When it changes significantly, then this is kind of an iterative process. But we're trying to answer the question, how many threads can I support? On page 52, we have an example of another chart of a different customer. Once more, it's a version 7 customer, and this DB2 has been up for quite a while. And they knew that their peak times were the first 5 business days of the month. So a couple of things. There's one thing that's very interesting about this, and no, it's not the abrupt drop. But if you'll notice on the pink line exceeds 200 by a little bit, kind of pokes up against it and exceeds it a little bit. As it turns out, that was a C-thread value. And in fact, at a peak time, about 125,000 or 30% of their threads were 2 to thread create in a 30-minute period. So they hit the maximum. So what this means is that it means that the maximum value I calculated also has to do with the fact that we hit C threads for 200. So proceeding cautiously, I might choose 325 threads, but it's important to run this again following the change, because the C thread value was the first thing that caused that put a breaking action on this. The other apparent break, or BREAK, from this thing was when was the abrupt drop. As it turned out, that somewhere around 101.58. What happened there was that this covered a weekend, And from midnight Friday night to Sunday morning at midnight, they didn't run this thing. So that's why you see it. That's why it looks like a sharp drop. So from a summary standpoint, for virtual storage, and this one I'm hoping that you're going to be able to take this and use it in your own environment and actually measure this, even if you don't have DB2PAM. One of the things is customers can be absolutely shocked to find out how much storage compressed data consumes. And one customer compressed all data sets greater than 10 megabytes in its tool. Another customer compresses every data set. Well, each data set takes 16 pages for the compression dictionary. So if you had a 14-page data set and you have a 16-page compression dictionary, this is something that doesn't make sense. And by the way, that compression dictionary at open time has to be loaded in DVM virtual storage, one virtual storage, which, as you guessed it, in version 7 is below the bar. In version 8, it's above the bar. But this customer who had many DB2 add-ins for virtual storage failure had no idea until I ran an earlier version of this for him that almost all of his members were between 450 to 500 meg for compressed data sets, which was about a third of the available storage. So word to the wise, use compression, but use it wisely. Menu 2 also shows how many times you had critical storage compaction occur. So this is a good thing to know because you wouldn't normally do this. There was a customer that had an 8-way data sharing group, and they said, well, how many threads can I have? So should I clone? The rule of thumb says we clone all our DB2s so anything can run anywhere. Well, there's some reasons not to do this. In this case, this customer had 2 batch members, 3 online members, and 2 distributed members. So if you had a common C thread value, let's say based on the batch members, there's a lot of capacity you're leaving on the table. So my recommendation was to use 1 C thread value for each of 3 workload types so that you can provide failover and get the benefit of the capacity. The downside is there's a little bit more maintenance for your DSNZ pumps, which normally I would prefer to keep about the same to avoid this problem. Now, all of the documented information, you can look at DB2 version 8 performance topics, section 4.3, for the detail on all of these values that I have described, and it's very good. It's been updated a lot since the version 7 selected performance topics. The menu package, you can get it at the DB2 trading post, at the DB2 website that's shown in your handout. And this one works for both version 7 and for version 8. So I'm finished at this point with virtual storage. And I'm going to go on to something about ICF-only configuration, internal coupling facilities. These are the most common parallel sysflex CF configuration today. And, well, why would that be? Well, on page 56, we look at a typical configuration of the 2000. In the simplest terms, we have 2 boxes, Z990s, system Z9. On the left, we have MVSA with its DB2 and IRLM, and we have an internal coupling facility which is holding the primary group buffer pool. On the right hand, we have DB2, we have another system Z9 that's got MVSB and its DB2 and the lock, the SCA, and the secondary copies of the group buffer pool. This is a pretty simple explanation. We have a lot fewer processors with many, many fast engines. And ICF requires fewer links than external coupling facilities, and also they process very, very much faster with the DB2 that's on the same image. So one of the design points of parallel sysflex is that there is fast recovery from single failure. If we have an image failure, then we can restart that image. If MVSB fails, we can have ARM restarted on MVSA quickly. If one of the CFs fails, the lock on the SCA are going to be rebuilt in the other structure if it happens to be the one on the right. If it's the one affecting the group buffer pools, then it'll fall back to simplex in second. So that's the typical configuration. So that's a single point of failure. But what if we have a double point of failure? That is, we have a processor on which we've got a ZOS image and its DB2, IRLM, and the SCA or lock fails. What's going to happen there? That is a double failure, not a single failure. So what's going to happen is the lock and the SCA are going to rebuild in the other processor. So far, so good. However, each IRLM contributes its part of the lock structure and the SCA structure in its own virtual storage for a fast rebuild. Well, IRLMA is going to contribute its part, but IRLMB cannot even respond or participate until MBSB has failed. Rebuild cannot complete. When it's recognized that DB2 and IRLMB are down, then we can't be successful in rebuilding over to the A box, so we're going to fall back to the original SCA and lock structures, and they're not accessible because the box is down. Now what happens is that data sharing group has to fail. In order to preserve data integrity, the entire data sharing group goes down. In this case, we're talking about two-way, but what if we were talking about an eight-way? Eventually, MBSB is going to fail. And by the way, tell your ZOS people they can make it fast with isolate time versus prompt because you're not going to save a member that is in distress. Anyway, and also, by the way, people are very focused on saving or restarting the member that's down, the image that's down, whatever. The problem is you may have six or seven other DB2s whose work is timing out because you're waiting on retain lock held by that failed DB2. So sometimes the focus is in the wrong area and it can make an outage worse. So restarting the group, the outage can be short. This is on page 58. After the MBS and DB2 fails, ARM can restart DB2B on another processor very fast, and that's the recommended way to do it. The start of DB2A is a group restart to rebuild the SCA and the lock. And by the way, that can be done even if DB2 is still down, if it's marked fail, but it can't happen until it's failed. Well, if you've got well-behaved units of work, it takes only a little more time than a normal restart. However, if you have long-running threads that don't commit, which we're always preaching against, it's going to have to read the log from the oldest you are to recreate the lock structure. If that's been running an hour, guess what? That's how long it's going to take. What about my group buffer pools? Well, they're in simplex mode, so they're fine. There's nothing in GRECP or LPL as long as they're duplex. What solutions do I have? What possibilities do I have? I have systems managed duplexing for the DB, and that's under 59 ICF availability solutions. System managed duplexing for the DB2 lock and SCA structures. You need an additional ICF engine in each ICF, typically, two more ICB links for the CF to CF links, and additional capacity in the host engine in each Z990 or system Z9. And when you do all that, the lock requests are going to be about four times higher duplex than simplex. So it's going to be 60 microseconds versus 9 to 15. And probably they'll be converted to async. Another solution is to have an external CF such that as a Z890 or a system Z9BC, a smaller one, it requires two ICB links from each processor, but no additional host overhead. So the SCA and lock structures can now rebuild into the ICF if the external CF fails, and now we're back to a single point of failure. And the lock requests are going to be probably synchronous. So that's a consideration that's true for most people are going to choose solution two. If the locking rate's low, we may do that. We may take solution one, and in fact, we recommended it for a customer just recently. And at the end of the presentation, I have some information more on duplexing and multi-site parallel cisplex too, which people want. Okay, I am now going to talk about usual suspects, starting on page 60. And on page 61, I'm going to talk about the most common thing that happens. Long-running updaters, runaways. A failure to commit, you get increased locking overhead. All your lock avoidance mechanisms fail. And then you can get lock escalation. So it inhibits concurrency from other users. Oh, causing timeouts and deadlocks for other workloads. Utilities can't break in, and don't forget about long-running readers. Because of that, you may have a high rollback rate, I've seen 10 to 15%. And guess what? We can have an increase in thread-related storage if we're not committing and we're continually acquiring storage. And if you'll think back to the virtual storage section. Several years ago, what happened to a customer was that their locking rates went up for a while. They got up as high as 100,000 lock requests a second on 9672 hardware. And, oh, by the way, it was keeping up. The CF was 80% busy, which is higher than we recommend at 40 to 50%. And then after a while, everything went back to normal. The transaction response time went 10 to 20 seconds versus about a tenth. And the CF lock time increased from 20 microseconds to about 35 microseconds. What happened to them? After several weeks, tough determination was a DDF transaction that had been changed recently from reading to updating, and it had started 8 hours earlier and had done a few updates. It was a very hard problem to solve. On page 62, everyone has long-running updaters. Some people have better or worse methods of getting around them. Some customers have not set the DSN ZParms that serve as a throttle. UR check threshold, number of checkpoints without a commit, and UR LGWTH, the number of updates that this UR has performed without a commit. Many years ago, customers were appalled when a job had run for 2 hours, and they then had to, they couldn't figure out whether they needed to cancel it because it was going to take twice as much time to roll back. And they said, gee, IBM, can you tell us when this is happening so that we can stop it before we get to a crisis point? Well, that's the value of these two parameters. So you can set them, and you can set them too high to do any good, or as the other customer, they had to set them at all, so they had no way of recognizing them. They could have figured it out pretty quickly if they'd had that set. Most customers do not cancel runaways, leaving exposures. One customer said, after 2 hours of this thing going, I can cancel it. Some of them trap messages and produce reports. Some have limits during the daytime, like 4 checkpoints, and some of them will have a change it at nighttime wide open. Well, now you've got a big problem when batch is running late. And don't forget about readers. Online reorg can't break in for the switch phase. Now, version 8 does not have a message. It has an ISC ID 313 to track it and a ZParm threshold. If you're an SAP customer, you have a transaction to identify it. But the rest of us are going to have to run a record trace for that. So how do I think you should plan to reduce runaways? And this is on page 63. Develop a long-term project to put commit scope into your application. Key to this is that you have to establish reasonable commit scope, and management on both the systems and application side need to support the project. Without it, you're not going to have any success. Set UR check threshold and UR LGWTH high at first, like 10 checkpoints and 100,000 updates. And that avoids flooding the console with messages initially. Produce reports to identify the offenders and encourage or require them to commit. Provide a reasonable deadline by which commits must be implemented or jobs will be canceled. Make a part of your migration plan the fact that demonstrating the use of the commit scope, a dynamic commit scope, by the way, store it in a DBT table, read it as the first immediately after a commit to get what the dynamic threshold is, whether it's 1 or 1,000. So that, because that can be changed as your online or batch requirements change. Then reduce the UR check threshold and continue until you achieve whatever the business goal is. It's not a decision you and I made. That's a decision that is done by the business. So some other things on page 65. In these cases, I've seen high rollback rates. One large user had 12% in 30 minutes for 1,000 rollbacks a minute. Another had 14% in 15 minutes for 20,000 a minute. So that means there's lots of work to undo, and the process has never been optimized. It's not a high-performance path. It wastes resources on processing work, even more to roll it back, and it's must-commit work, and increases the stress on the system. Long-running URs are also fixing the group-wide CLSN with commit log sequence number, reducing the effectiveness of lock avoidance, increasing the use of resources, as happened to this customer, and the operational cost for all applications, not just the rogue ones. But now you need to identify, figure out why are you having these rollbacks and work to eliminate them. One disciplined user had less than 1% peak admin for 15 minutes for 70 a minute, and most of the other 6 members' totals were in the single digits. So you can do this. Now, on page 66, the only version 8 information that I have seen on a customer to date is from the new batching commands that are available in compatibility mode. So what are these commands? The design point of these is to take a single entry coupling facility request, such as write and register page. And for example, if one of them takes 30 microseconds on a synchronous round trip, maybe it takes 10 microseconds on the CFCPU. So what we want to do is create a single request that has a list of multiple pages to do. For example, we might bundle 20 write and register page requests into write and register multiple, and these are CF-type macro instructions. They will run in 200 microseconds on a CF, 20 times 10, so they run in the same amount of time on the CF. And they don't save that, but they do save host and link time. So we really don't want, and in this case, it's probably going to be async, so we're going to spare the processor. It's invoked in compatibility mode, but you have to reallocate the group buffer pool. You don't get it until you do. So tools to use to look at this. The RMS, CF Activity Report, is giving the service time for each group buffer pool. And DB2PM group buffer pool sections has number of CF requests in fields that call write and register multiple, which is warm, read for cast out multiple. Those are the two things that you look at. And you look at the number of requests, not the number of pages. So on page 67, I have a little sample of the effect, calculating the effects of CF batching. And if you'll look down at the circled information, you'll see that we have asynchronous requests, 761,000. We have change, which is about 27%, which would be high for version 7. We have 65,000 that are changed. And if you'll look over a little bit to the right, under delayed request, there's an underlined field called no SCH. That's 65,000. We used that because there were those were sub-channel busy. So those 65,000 don't count because they were waiting for sub-channel busy. So now we've got 696,000. Going to the DB2PM report for total write and register multiple and read for cast out multiple requests, and I totaled those up at about 671,000. And that's about 95% of the 696,000, the percentage async that were for CF batching, which is about right. The rest of the requests are converted to async based on their service time, which is sparing the host CPU spin time is the goal for the heuristic ZOS algorithm of converting from sync to async. So that's my experience there. Page 69, DBQ restart after image failure. As I said earlier, the focus in an image failure is typically on getting that image back up. And I think that can be a real problem, and it can elongate outages and bring on critical situations. Many customers rely on slow manual procedures for restart. If you're going to manually restart DB2 on another image, it can take you 5 or 10 minutes. Now, if you've lost the image and you're going to wait to IPL it to start DB2, that's going to be 30 to 60 minutes. And you've got six other members that are up that are timing out because this DB2 that's down has retained locks. That's way too long. Think of the members that are up. So most people do have automation for in-place restarts. But if they don't have it, they can use ARM. Part of the ZOS product is free. Where it's very useful is in cross-system restart. That is, I'm going to start DB2A over on MVSB simply to get rid of the retained lock. And it can do that in about 10 to 15 seconds. And, by the way, you can restart it for normal activity if you've got enough capacity and have planned for, or you can restart it for light capacity. Light is where DB2 starts with a very small footprint, tiny buffer pools, no EDM pool, no ability to start new work. It's just reading logs and trying to get rid of all the retained locks, and then it shuts itself down. But some customers cannot implement ARM because it requires a JIS mask called multi-access spool. And that's a ZOS concern, and most U.S. customers have that ability. And then it's pretty easy to implement and to do. Restart Lite is improved in version 8, and it will stay up for a commit coordinator, including GDF, but it won't let you start any new work. It knows. Data sets with IXL locks, parent locks, which are not happen to not be shared, are not held in X mode. So now these data sets are accessible by other DB2s. So the important thing is to focus on the DB2 that is get that failed DB2 up as quickly as possible because of the effect of the other DB2 members. Okay, there's some other things that are important that I haven't seen. Some of them I haven't seen. Page 70. The others, hey, you've been told by DB2 development that paging is critical with buffer pools that are in data spaces or for version 8. The recommendation is the same because all paging goes to DASD, and we don't want that to happen. The rule of thumb is if it's less than 1% paging, fine. If it's 2-4%, investigate and tune. If it's 5%, reduce size if you don't have enough backing central storage. I haven't seen problems to date, but your notes give you the exact formulas of how you can calculate these rates. One thing I've seen is where the packages are not found in the first few collections in the PK list, and you're going to see package allocation attempts versus successes is not one-to-one. I don't care if it's the first two or three, but if you have a package list that's got 10 or 11 collections and you're always finding in the 11th, you're wasting a lot of resource. PCLOSE T, we try to keep you down to fewer than 20 a minute. We want to reduce open data sets by use of closed yes data sets for most table spaces. Now, closed no, which used to be the default, and everybody used to use that, has had in the last several years a change in behavior. And what that change was made for data sets that are absolutely critical, cannot possibly go through a physical open after they've been closed when there's no data sharing. So data sets that would apply to this are data sets that are needed at first of day when you're opening a lot of data sets at once. The first transaction would be performed very slowly. So those are data sets that are appropriate for closed no. But if I have a data set that's closed no and it is root buffer pool dependent on Monday, and it stops being root buffer pool dependent on Monday, and we're still doing things on Wednesday, it's still going to be writing pages to the root buffer pool because that's what you told it you are willing to trade. So I would say most data sets should be closed yes. Justify the ones that are closed no. Logging. Logging, I ask customers this, can't verify it. I want your active log copy 1 and active log copy 2 on separate DASD subsystems. Why do I want that? Because even a DASD subsystem can fail and may not be able to be recovered. Same different LSSs, a little bit less exposure, but still, if that subsystem fails, you've got a problem. And that's a DASD subsystem, not the DE2 subsystem. Because if we fail, then, and your current active log happens to be on the failed device, you have data integrity problems and you have no way to tell where the problems might be. And I always ask the DB2 people to get your DASD people to tell you where these data sets on these volumes really reside. Because with array devices, we really don't know. For multi-volume archive logs, some customers have increased the size of their active logs greatly, which is a good thing, but they haven't increased the size of their archive logs. And I saw one customer that every time they logged had 5 archive logs created. These were, you know, tapes. These were VTS type ones, but 5 of them. And that consumes spaces in the Bootstrap data set, which in version 7 is 1,000. Determine your active log residency. Make it relative to image copy cycle for critical table spaces and also with DASD logs. Okay, page 73. I said I discussed multi-site locking issues. People would like to spread their parallel sysplex across 2 different sites. But there's a couple of inherent problems with it. Some of them want to use GDPS, but in essence, they'd have a coupling facility at one site and another one at the other site. And in order to avoid a complete restart with a lot of data sets in GRECP and so forth, they will duplex their group buffer pools, and in certain circumstances, that would work. Now, what are they going to do about the lock in the SCA? So what they would like to do is see what's it going to take, can I duplex my lock in SCA? So for a system Z990, a sync lock request can be about 10 microseconds with fast links, or maybe up to 20 with slower ones. If I'm doing system managed duplexing of the lock in the SCA, I've got to have CF to CS signals. And remember, I said locally, about 4 times if a duplex lock is about 4 times the cost of a simplex block, and that's just local. Distance is going to add 10 microseconds a kilometer at the best case speed. That would be the speed of light round trip. And guess what? It's not as the airplane flies, but it's as the dark fiber is laid. So 30 kilometers could take considerably more than 30 kilometers by the time you get this dark fiber. So if sites are about 30 kilometers apart, then that would take about 300 microseconds. If it's duplex, then triple that or quadruple that, and it's about 1 millisecond per lock request, and it's not practical. I have seen one customer with system managed duplexing. They were duplexing across 5 kilometers, a little over 3 miles. They were running 5,400 lock requests a second. Their synchronous lock requests were 95 microseconds, which makes sense, and it was 225 async in a 4-way data sharing group, and because of the distance, almost all of it was async, so that was 225 microseconds. So that I'm trying to discourage the use of multi-site duplexing. The last page has to do with the DSNZ PARMs, and I'm not going to cover these. This is a list of some of the DSNZ PARMs that I'm interested in from a standpoint of a health check. And so I'm going to leave those for you because I have a small explanation, but of course the installation guide is your best option. So I'm now ready to open. Could you open the floor for questions, please?
Thank you. The question and answer session will be conducted electronically today. If you would like to ask a question, you may signal us by pressing the star key followed by the number 1 on your telephone. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your phone, and we'll pause for a moment. And we'll take a question from Harry.
Is Mark there?
Yes, I am.
Hi. Mark, in terms of ARM, is there a good current sort of cookbook that sort of, you know, lays out in excruciating detail what your ARM policy should be to do, you know, DB2 restart light and to handle the double failure scenario?
That's actually a couple questions. One, is there an ARM cookbook? And there's been actually the ARM material has been around for a long time. So I would say the early Parallel Sysplex cookbooks, the red books called Parallel Sysplex cookbook, probably have good ARM information. And I would, for most ARM stuff, I would direct you to the standard ZOS product documentation. I don't, other than the early Parallel Sysplex cookbooks, I haven't seen a recent red book of that type. So that was question number one. And yes, it goes into the older cookbooks may miss a few of the new parameters, but the ZOS product guides will give you all the new parameters. Now, the other question was avoiding the double failure scenario. The only way to avoid the double failure scenario is to keep your lock structure and your SCA independent of the footprint where a DB2 member resides, right? That's where the double failure scenario kicks in. Now, the way to get ARM to do restart light is when you actually code the ARM policy, the ARM specification includes the names of the subsystems you're going to restart. So you can put in DB2, and you can put in KIX, and you can put in IMS, and everything else in your ARM policy. And you can have one set of rules for same system restart and a set of rules for cross-system restart. And in the case of cross-system restart, you can put, if you actually put a parameter, which is the start command that ARM will enter for you, and you just say restart light in that parameter.
So
does that answer the question?
I think so. So does ARM basically sort of just execute a set of commands that you provide it?
What ARM does is it will, you specify under what circumstances you under what circumstances you want things to get restarted.
Right.
So one of the advantages of ARM is it's built into the operating system, so it gets control before any of your scheduling or automation packages get control. It's, you know, it's earlier down. So the Parallel Sysplex will be aware of what ARM's trying to do sooner. That's
right.
One advantage. And then you can have ARM set up to do same system restart, like if just DB2 falls over, or cross system restart, like you lose an LPAR. Right.
And in each of those cases, you just provide it with the actual start command that you would have done manually, except then ARM does it for you?
Correct. And therefore, it happens a lot more quickly.
Oh, okay.
Right. Part of what you want to do with the ARM scenario is you want to automate the restart of the members on an LPAR that may have disappeared. Right. If an LPAR fails for some reason, you don't want to wait until someone does an operator reply to say that system is down. You want, you know, Sysplex failure management to do it automatically, and then ARM will kick in, and those subsystems that you care about, right. For example, if you have an LPAR and you've got a production DB2 and a test DB2, you're not going to restart the test DB2 cross-system.
Right.
Right. You'll let those users suffer for a little while.
Right.
So you can tell that in ARM. You can also specify in ARM that you don't want DB2 restarted in an LPAR that's constrained by storage, for example,
right.
Or doesn't have enough CSA. Those are all things you can specify in the ARM policy.
Okay. And are there examples of that in that the ZOS product doc?
There should be, because I haven't looked in that doc, really recently, but there should be because that's where I saw it back when it first came out.
Oh, okay.
Of course, back then it wasn't called ZOS, it was or ZOS, it was called OS390, but same thing.
Oh, okay. Now, on page 69, it says that ARM can restart DB2 automatically in 10 to 15 seconds, and that looks about 7 times faster than what was published for DB2 in the version 7 performance document, Red Book. And I'm curious whether this 7 times improvement is due to, you know, running on a 7 times faster CPU, or is there some other reason why it's so much faster?
Well, that's an interesting question. I am not sure if what Judy means by the 10 to 15 seconds is that DB2 is all the way up, or that in 10 to 15 seconds, DB2 has already started the restart process, because, of course, it can take longer than this if there are a lot of locks to clear.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So depending on your... Again, assuming we had an LPAR failure, DB2 is going to have to go back and start recovering locks. So I can't assume that all the locks will be recovered in 10 to 15 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that the command could have been issued that quickly and the process started, that I can believe.
Okay, so this is more... the start, this sort of the execution of the start command, start DB2.
So this is taking the human being out of the equation.
Right. Because by the time a live operator sees that the LPAR has failed and then decides to to reply down for that system and then turns around and issues all the starts for the subsystems that he remembers need to be started, it'll be a lot longer than this before anyone ever gets around to issuing DB2 start.
Right. Now, I'm more curious about sort of the difference between what was in the, you know, version 7 performance document and here, because this looked much better. But your explanation of that it's not including the actual DB2 restart processing, which is, you know, variable depending on your workload, makes sense.
For example, if you violate Judy's recommendation earlier of committing frequently and you have a long-running update transaction.
Yes.
And is holding a lot of locks, then he's going to have to figure out what to do with them.
Right. Back about page 60 or 61, Judy was talking about this mysterious circumstance where at certain periods of time it would reach 100,000 lock requests per second. And then it was sort of said that this was due to a DDF transaction, which was read-only, but had started doing updating. Does that mean that this was a DDF transaction that was doing 100,000 updates per second?
No. What she was describing was a problem that both Mark and I were involved with some time ago. The situation was someone didn't realize that they had a long-running unit of recovery.
Okay.
And because they didn't realize it, the group commit log sequence number was very old, so they were not getting lock avoidance.
Oh, okay.
No lock avoidance in the system means all possible locks were being taken, and therefore there was a very high rate of lock activity to the coupling facility.
Okay.
That rate of activity was such that we were able to see how fast a Model 100 could handle a lock.
Okay.
That's what that was about.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Say, Mark, let me just make a comment about one of Judy's early visuals. She mentions version 8 and new function mode. What she meant by that is that none of us on the team have had an opportunity to do a health check on a data sharing group in version 8 new function mode. It has nothing to do with the number of customers. There are many, many customers out there who are in version 8 in new function mode, both in data sharing and non-data sharing. So just want to make sure nobody misunderstood that.
That's a good point. I know I'm personally aware of a customer I worked with closely who's happily new function mode in data sharing. Okay, next question, please.
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, you may signal us by pressing *1 on your phone. We'll hear again from Harry.
Mark, again, back on FOIL 53, Judy talked about an example where, according to DB2PM, 125,000 threads per second were queued for thread create. And she said that this was represented 30% of the workload, which means that the workload was doing 231.5 thread creates per second for a 30-minute period. And I'm sort of curious because, you know, in a Kix environment, I would normally want to be doing thread reuse. And I'm curious as to what was driving such a high thread create activity for 30 minutes.
That's a good question. Since I was not involved with her on putting this particular set of charts together, this particular graph that we're looking at, you're talking about the one on page 52 and the notes accompanying on 53?
Yes.
Right. So there are several things when you say acute at thread create. All that means, well, I mean, fundamentally that means there's more requests for create thread than DB2 can handle immediately.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Now, whether, I don't know the circumstances that got this. Sure, I would like to reuse Kix threads too, but I can't tell whether these are, whether all that she's got described here are Kix threads or not.
Fair enough. In terms of page 67, which is the sort of CF RMF report.
Right.
Which was specifically talking about CF batching. But
right.
I was sort of looking at the line above for synchronous requests.
Right.
And I sort of read it as saying that it takes over 60 microseconds, over 36.6 microseconds to do just a simple synchronous request. And based on our, you know, the things about 15 microseconds for a lock request, 36.6 seems a high number.
Well, again, the RMF report, when you get it and you get down to this page, you have no information about the physical configuration.
Uh-huh.
Right? So the physical configuration in this scenario could be something where they had back-level CFs.
Okay.
It could be something where they were doing structured duplexing.
Okay.
Right? Now, I would expect the number to be higher if it were structured duplexing. But I can't tell you where, you know, which, I don't know which customer this one came from.
Okay.
Okay.
And as a further curiosity question, what was highlighted also was that 65,000 of the requests had changed, and then it was said that that was because there was no subchannel, the subchannel was busy.
Right.
And I sort of think of that as being a bad thing, the subchannel being busy, or am I misinterpreting that?
Well, you certainly would rather the subchannel not be busy, but what this, when this corresponds to the one we talked about earlier on the phone, if the CF link,
right,
or the CF itself is busy at the time that the operating system tries to schedule the CF request, then it comes back subchannel busy.
So either
the subchannel it chose,
yes,
or the CF out there is already busy.
So it's a sign of contention at a link or CF CPU level.
Probably. Now, I would hate to go too far down this conjectural path without knowing their configuration in more detail.
Right.
It's possible, again, if this were an older CF, it's possible also they didn't have as many engines as I would like out there.
Yeah, okay.
Right? So if one of them is busy handling a request from the other system, then our faster CPU would say, oh, gee, I'm getting really lousy response time. Right? And then the other thing is if he starts getting a lot of subchannel busies, then he's going to give up and say, listen, I can't wait for this.
Right.
Because otherwise, even when you get a subchannel busy, the host CPU waits, or spins, I should say.
Right. Right, except when it changes to asynchronous, then it doesn't wait. Is that true?
That's correct.
It will wait until it gets the subchannel or until it gives up, and then it will change it to asynchronous.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see.
Right.
Okay.
So where she made the comment, no subchannel, when you look down at the async 761 and see she subtracted out the 65,000
yes.
for no subchannel.
Right.
Right, because some of those became, you know, that's what the changed. The third
Mark, point. I think we got to move on to the next question.
That's a good point.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We'll now hear from Kurt Bonner.
Hi. On foil 72, there's a comment for closed node data sets and group buffer pool dependency. And the comment says once group buffer pool dependent, they remain so even if no other members. And the comment stops there. I presume what you're saying is even if no other members, even if there is, if IDRI no longer exists, the dependency still exists?
Page 72.
Yeah. Okay, now it might be page 70 for you because I noticed we were off two pages between what I have and what you have.
Yes, I'm looking on page 70.
Okay.
So depending on which set of charts. That's, okay.
Right.
So you're talking about the...
The comment under close, no.
Yes. Okay, so here's the thing. At one point, even if you specified closed no, when the last inter-DB2 read-write interest went away, DB2 could choose to physically close. But now, and this was some years ago, now even if you specify close no, you will not change. You will pseudo-close, right? You'll go down to logical close, but you won't physically close the data set.
Correct.
And this means that if you have two members that are active and one of them stops using the object, that the object will stay group buffer pool dependent. That's what her bullet is saying here.
Correct. Even if Idri went away.
Even if one member stopped using it, because you've chosen to specify this data set as not being a candidate to close, right? You said close no.
That's correct.
So we won't do a physical close. It was the process of physical close that would then alert the other system, hey, nobody is interested in this anymore. You can now take it over. You can escalate your PLOC,
mm-hmm.
you know, entire mm-hmm. ownership, you know, read or write, as the case may be.
And pseudo-close would not accomplish that.
Pseudo-close.
If you went into a read-only status, is there a reason why you would have to maintain a group buffer pool dependency?
Well, that's how the way the mechanism used to work was. It was the going to the physical close on the side that wasn't using it anymore,
mm-hmm.
allowed the side that was still using it to stop treating it like group buffer pool dependent.
I understand.
If you specify close no, we don't go through that.
I understand.
So that means, true, if you have a case where mm-hmm. typically one system is accessing it and occasionally the other guy does, and it's close no, that occasional use means the guy who uses it most of the time will be following group buffer pool dependent rules, right? Checking group buffer pool on not found cases, writing change pages out there, and ready to
mm-hmm.
read pages.
And only a physical close
right.
will
now,
actually reset them.
Now, I believe we'll still reset. We won't reset all the way down to an S or an X PLOC, but we'll get
mm-hmm.
back to SIX, where if the guy who's doing most of the work is the sole updater,
mm-hmm.
then he doesn't have to register pages read, but he still has to write his pages out, and he still has to check on a not found condition in his local pool.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And there are no further questions.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, for taking time out of your busy schedules to attend Data Sharing Health Checks, What We Have Learned. A special thanks goes out to not only Judy, but also Mark Rader and Mark Anders for answering all those wonderful questions today. If you should have any additional questions, please do not hesitate to contact me, and I will be glad to put you in touch with either a DB2 sales or DB2 technical sales specialist. Check out our website. We do have our next teleconference on September 7th, which is on data sharing, and we'd love to have you join us. So take care, have a wonderful day, and goodbye, and glad you could attend.
Thank you. That does conclude today's conference call. We thank you for your participation, and have a great day.